You're listening to Bricks and Mortar from EG, presented by Sarah Jackman. Today I'm delving into the field of break clauses. In other words, the ability of the party to a lease to be able to terminate the agreement. There is a substantial body of case law that governs the operation of break clauses, which has built up over many years and continues to evolve. That case law requires strict compliance with the conditions of the lease to ensure its effectiveness, but with so many variants to take account of, the potential for disputes over the validity of the break is high. To help guide listeners through the potential minefield is property litigator Helena Davis, a partner at Brabner's law firm in Manchester. She has a particular specialism in commercial leasehold work and acts for both landlords and tenants across the full range of contentious matters, including break clauses. Good afternoon, Helena.
Hello.
Welcome to the studio and thank you very much indeed for joining me today. We're going to chat about break clauses, which I know is a key topic for any property litigator. Let's start at the beginning. Describe for me what a break clause is. What are we talking about?
Oh, thank you for having me, Sarah.
Pleasure.
Okay, so a break clause is a provision in a lease which allows one party to terminate the lease early. So if you assume a fixed term lease, say of 10 years, 20 years, obviously you could have an option to break the lease at some point prior to that, after 5 years, after 10 years, and so on. You can have a rolling break option, so the option continues after a certain period to be exercised at any time. Or you can have a fixed break. So if you miss the opportunity, then you've had it and the lease will run on to the full term. And that obviously is the type that causes the most disputes, of course. There can be landlord's break options as well as tenant break options, but the ones where we're normally litigating, not always, but usually are the tenant breaks where you've got conditionality and all sorts of things which we can talk about.
And when we're looking at the commercial lease in its totality, just how important is the break clause to it?
Well, the option to break can be a key part of the negotiation. The usual negotiating piece goes along the lines of landlord wanting to take the tenant for as long as possible for various reasons, obviously certainty of income stream, maximising the value of the asset. So the longer the lease, the better the position the landlord has when going out to lenders. The lender will want a long lease for security, so the longer the lease, the bigger the lending facility and all this sort of mm-hmm. thing. Tenant obviously depends on the market, but usually he wants security for his business, but he also wants flexibility. Mm. So looking at the current market, many tenants are nervous to take on too much real estate. They've been nervous to look too far into the future. Nobody knows quite where it's going to go. So they're looking for either a short term, or the compromise is, of course, the long term with a break option.
Yeah.
Although one thing was that SDLT is still payable on the full term, so mm-hmm. that can be another negotiating point. But it's a major issue when parties are talking about leases.
Yeah, okay. And when we're thinking about the drafting of break clause provisions, is there such a thing as a standard break clause, or do they vary quite substantially?
There are standards that are best practice, and there's things like the Code of Practice for Commercial Leases, there's the Law Society Model Lease. These things are endorsed by the various professional institutions, Law Society, RICS, British Property Federation, those sorts of things. So there are standards, and in those standards there are things like there shouldn't be any conditions other than the principal rent and giving up occupation, not even vacant possession, but really, really simple conditions. So, and also there's a standard for allowing repayment of the overpayment of rent you've made in order to break. So there's some things that are very tenant friendly and very straightforward, but that is not to say that leases are standard in this respect, because absolutely the opposite is true, and every lease that comes on my desk is different from the one before, so that's what keeps me busy.
Okay. So historically then, I mean, break clauses have been something that people can trip themselves up on. They can become contentious between parties. What do people need to be aware of when they're drafting or reviewing commercial leases?
You're absolutely right. They're a minefield. There was a case, Siemens and Friends Life, in which Lord Justice Lewison said, if you want to avoid expensive litigation and the possible loss of a valuable right to break, you must pay close attention to all the requirements of the clause and follow them precisely. Right. Which sounds so straightforward. But obviously all the requirements of the clause, that can be, depending on what's drafted, really, really quite difficult. So when you're at the drafting stage, the party who's going to want to rely on that clause needs to fire test what's being put in there, the wording. you need to make sure that it can be exercised, easily exercised, that there are no ambiguities, no bizarre complicated requirements to trip you up. I mean, we basically break down the process into the three components. There's form of a notice, service of a notice, and then there's the conditions. And all those areas can provide challenges depending on how they're drafted. So what I would say is that at heads of term stage, it's really important for the parties, and that might be the parties themselves, might be before the lawyers get involved, might be the surveyors, to actually think about what they want that break option to look like. Quite often heads of terms don't give that level of detail. That helps if people have already thought, and there could be some serious deal breakers in there about what that break option looks like. I say the sort of things that do trip people up, that those creating the provisions in the first place need to think about the break date. So how is that defined? Is it is it an actual date? Is it the start or end of an anniversary date? Mm. And then do you tie that in with rent reviews and payment days? There's quite a lot to think about with that. How much notice is to be given? It's really important you don't say on so many months' notice, that you say not less than, because all these things, there are cases on all these things. Service, is it mandatory or permissive? Obviously, permissive is better because it means you can serve in many ways. You don't have to. There are cases where you had to serve a certain way, and it doesn't matter whether the other party received it or not. If you didn't do what it said, the notice was invalidly served and of no effect. So there are quite a lot of things to think about. I recommend getting a property litigator to take a good look at it.
All right. So you touch on conditions. We've mentioned or alluded to the fact that break clauses require strict compliance with those conditions. Those conditions have famously included reference in one particular case to service on a particular colour of paper. Can you touch on where we are now in terms of those cases and that approach?
Yeah, so absolutely. That reference is from Manai Investment and Eagle Star, which is probably the leading case in the area. And you're absolutely right. Lord Hoffman said it, if a break clause had said the notice had to be on blue paper, it would have been no good serving a notice on pink paper, however clear it might have been that the tenant wanted to terminate the lease, which does seem bizarre and has led to extensive case law on notices and whether they fall into that trap or not. The odd thing is that the Manai principle is actually, it's where minor defects don't necessarily invalidate the notice. So it's actually quite difficult to look at a defect and decide what is this, is it bad enough or is it going to be okay? So the Manai principle is actually that minor defects in these unilateral contractual notices will not necessarily invalidate the notice if the reasonable recipient with knowledge of the factual and contextual background would not be perplexed by the error. So you've got one end, you've got this really strict interpretation, and indeed it's the case that these unilateral contractual provisions are going to be construed strictly and against the person trying to rely on them. But then you've got a lot of cases where people are trying to sneak into this principle of, yes, but it's the reasonable person would understand what you were trying to achieve. So then you've got just a flurry of cases. You've got Trafford Metropolitan Borough Council and Total Fitness, and that one breaks it into two sort of tests, saying when you're looking at this, you've got the first part, which is determining what the notice says, and the second part, which is whether the contents of the notice match with the notice requirements. And Trafford and Total Fitness says that Manai has no application to the second stage. So there are some things that will never be okay no matter what you do, and things like getting it to the wrong party, the wrong address, the wrong method of service, that will kill your notice. Really, you'd be looking at typos and things to be comfortable under the Manai principle. Some cases, Hot Group and RBS, that was a case where the lease specifically required the notice to be served on the landlord with a copy to the managing agent. They served it on the landlord, they didn't serve a copy of the managing agent, and the break was defective just because they didn't do what the lease said. So there's some harsh cases. One I mentioned earlier, which is the Siemens and Friends Life one, which is where the lease required you the tenant to make reference to an express provision in the 1954 Act, which in fact was had no meaning by then, really. So the break was served without that express reference, and again, it was no good. you really, it's very difficult to decide. The main thing is try to be accurate and not get into that position in the first place, which is easy to say.
So those cases then evidence of the fact that the courts are willing to uphold strict compliance even when doing so might potentially be deemed unfair. In your view, is that right? Is that the correct approach?
So difficult to say because, I mean, as a practitioner, clients want certainty. That's what it's all about. They don't want a last thing anybody wants is a legal battle. And clients are often surprised when they find that the break right that they've got in their lease isn't a certainty, that it's fraught with potential risk. That's not what they bargained for. So it's not good that we've got this situation. Obviously, commercial workable rulings from the court are always better for actual businesses and occupiers and landlords also. And something I said earlier that I probably should have clarified, landlords sometimes have break options which are really valuable for them as well if they want to redevelop or something. So it isn't always the tenant that's got this problem. It's not very workable at the moment, and that's not ideal. That said, you need to have a rule, and these are free negotiated contracts. So without the rule of law, we couldn't even advise. Yeah. So very difficult. I don't have an answer to that.
Okay. Let's move on then. What happens if the conditions haven't been complied with? So you're looking at a lease, you can see that the tenant hasn't complied with the break clause provisions. Is there any room for manoeuvre?
Well, not really, no. So the current market, you've got a situation where most likely situation is a tenant's trying to break a lease and the landlord is desperately trying to keep the tenant because they don't want another empty unit. So you've got a landlord will go to the property litigator and say, please find a way that this tenant has got it wrong, or find me a reason to not accept this break. So that's the backdrop in which the tenant is trying to exercise the break. Yeah. The arguments really are, I mean, if he hasn't satisfied the conditions, then it won't work. But has he satisfied the conditions? That's where you get the argument. So some of the most obvious conditions, which are, if we get past form and service, we're then talking about the conditions prerequisite to the break. So on the break date, you must yield up with vacant possession, you must have paid all the sums due under the lease, you must be in full compliance of the lease sometimes, and that will include the repairing obligation, which is impossible to satisfy if it's absolute like that. Lots of cases on all these types of conditions. So the repair one, we've got many cases saying that even trifling repairs, depending on the wording, all of these depend on the wording on the specific lease, but some basic principles, even trifling repairs and can invalidate the repair option. There was a case, West Country Cleaners said failure to paint in the last year of the term invalidated the break option. So the repair one is probably the worst. Vacant possession you'd think would be straightforward, but in recent years there've been cases on this where tenants have got it wrong. Riverside Park and NHS Property Services, failure to remove demountable partitioning meant they hadn't yielded up vacant possession. There's many of these. And then there's the payment ones, the payment conditions, of which a whole other category of cases. One very basic rule, which is an important one, is where the break date is between rent payment days, does the tenant have to pay the full rent due? Absolutely 100% yes. If you're unlucky, you could pay a whole quarter's rent ahead, even if it's about to break. That is decided. Never risk it. It's not worth it. And then obviously a big case, Marks and Spencers, a couple of years ago, about whether or not you could get that money back again. And that depends what the lease says. But unless the lease says you can, then that case found that you could not get your money back again. But then the interest horrors of Avocet, whereby £130 unpaid interest during the term, which had never even been asked for, managed to invalidate the break. So there's some really harsh cases. Systems need to be in place for a tenant that's got a one-off break that's conditional on these things. They need to get advice from surveyors, accountants, lawyers. It's not straightforward.
Mm. Okay. In practical terms then, I mean, what happens if either party wishes to break the commercial lease early? What options do they have?
Well, there are only a limited number of ways that a fixed term lease can be brought to an end early. So unilateral measures by the landlord include forfeiture, that tenant include disclaimer, but looking at an insolvency situation there, and the break option if you have one. Commercially, where we sometimes end up is surrender. That requires both parties to agree. Of course, it's consensual, but it might be worth a handsome payment from a tenant to get some certainty if his break, because it might be a break that's been drafted, you know, by solicitors who are not specialists and haven't given it due attention, or indeed he might have inherited the lease, and if he's bought a portfolio and found these break options, well, actually, instead of relying on them, it may be better to serve the break notice, give it a try for some leverage, but then I think a surrender premium and a surrender instead at least will give certainty.
Yeah. Okay. And so given that backdrop and given the fact that options are limited and things are, you know, fairly black and white, what advice would you give to parties currently reviewing a break clause in a lease?
Well, if you're about to serve notice or you're looking at exercising a break option, it's a sort of forensic exercise. Definitely need advice. It's not just a letter they can serve on their own. They may be lucky, but it's very high risk. So what we would do is you break it down into the form, the service and the conditions, and before anything else, timing. So if there's a fixed break date, diarise. Everyone has to diarise this last date for service, take in an extra week for service, look at the methods of service. Please, please, please do not instruct your solicitors on the last day for service, because that is unpleasant in the office. You need a lot of checks to take place, really. You've got to serve on the legal owners, so that means you're looking at getting all land registry details, hope that everything's registered land, a company's house. There's a lot of checking that goes into it. And then service, I mean, sometimes I feel a little bit like I'm in the Harry Potter, the first one, where the notice is served by thousands of owls coming in at the window, because I send so many notices and so many methods in order to make sure that we satisfy service and that it actually gets received in the right place. It can seem a little odd. Clients might think you're overdoing it, but I don't think that you necessarily can overdo it. Once you've got the notice served, then you've got to look at all the conditions. You're getting a surveyor involved, schedule dilapidations, try and trick the other side into an estoppel if you can. There's all sorts of things that you can do, but I think the commercial answer is if you want certainty and you've got one of these horrors of a break option, then you need to be thinking about making an offer for a surrender, probably.
Okay, and just to round off there, you touch on the many cases that are established in this area. What proportion of cases do you see that do actually go on to the court level?
They don't generally get to court. Obviously, there are many reported cases that have done, but I think there are thousands of disputed break options that don't go to court. And the reason for that is because to have a disputed break option is it's an unsatisfactory position, because a tenant has to make a decision: is he going to leave or is he going to stay? And the landlord needs to decide: is he going to, if he goes for a declaration that the lease hasn't broken, he's still got an empty property, and he'd have a tenant that wasn't in possession. You've got to think about securing his premises, and it's actually better to get it back on the market. He doesn't want a tenant that doesn't want to be there, not really. Maybe if he's got a brilliant covenant to keep them on the hook. There's always got to be some sort of deal to be done. He wouldn't presumably want an empty premises for another 5 years and having to sue every quarter for the rent. And yeah, I think commercially deals are done, but who pays who what is depends on how well parties have been advised beforehand, I think.
Okay. Helen Davis, thank you very much indeed for walking us through what I know is a very tricky area. You've been listening to Bricks and Mortar from EG with Sarah Jackman. For more information on developing a career in real estate, see the archive of the Bricks and Mortar series at podbean.com and the APC and Mainly for Students series at egi.co.uk.